current Real 12. We're talking about your time at Alexandria, at Amarilla Camp, just outside. I believe you had a draft there from the Leicesters and Sherwood Foresters.
Yes, we hadn't had enormous casualties. I think in the Baiwa and Sidi Barani thing, we had 7 officers killed or wounded and about 50 soldiers. But we still had been a bit under strength, so a big draft of NCOs and private soldiers was quite arbitrarily sent to us. And so one of the things that went on at this, this Amarilla camp, was in fact kitting out these people with Cameron uniforms, changing their camp badge, which must have been very disagreeable to them because they had enlisted in regiments with good histories and proud traditions and so on, and to be told from up above as a moment's notice that they're going to become something else must have been pretty bloody awful for them, I think. They took it very well. And in fact, they became very enthusiastic Cameron Highlanders. But that took a few weeks, even possibly a few months, to achieve. But it was a good example, I've always thought, of how a good unit could assimilate, and without any kind of overt preaching or teaching, the atmosphere of a good unit did pervade new people.
Would you spread? Were they spread out across the battalion, or would they?
Yes, no, they were spread out. There were something like over 50, I think, came to Charlie Company. So that every platoon had one or two. And
did they socialise initially with the Scots, or did they sort of stick together?
They'd socialise. Almost you had to, because in the same way that whether you liked or disliked somebody, there was no getting away from the fact that you were stuck with him, almost literally with him, in the desert and in your wherever you were stationed. I think the only slight difficulty was that most of the jocks spoke pretty broad Scots, and most of the newcomers spoke pretty broad Middle English. So there were just some problems of communication to begin with. This was a time when, you know, the Free French were in the air and the Free Poles and so on, and somebody christened them the Free British. The sort of nickname stuck. And I think they were quite amused by it. Some of them must have, I don't know, I can imagine possibly in some companies and some sections in every company, there may have been jocks who tried to needle them, but I never came across anything like that. And you had, of course, to you could say things to the jocks that you assumed that, meant something to them because it was based on some either regimental fact or some regimental joke. You had to make sure that the Free British didn't feel left out of this loop, that they were involved in the thing, particularly because they brought some good NCOs with them, and you know, even I at my level could see that we were really going to need good NCOs, and we had to get them on board very quick.
Now, anything else about your time at Amarilla?
I don't, can't, well...
You weren't there long.
No, very short time. This is about the first time I saw, it was the first time I saw army the legal system at work, so to speak, in as much as troops of people who had a good time, a high old time in Alex, but done nothing too obstreperous, were marched into the company office, as it was called, David Douglas sitting in judgment. You know, the penalties were 3 days confined to barracks, which meant nothing, of course, because no place. There were no barracks, and B, no place that you could go to. And serious ones were sent to the colonel, people who had, as I say, thought it was going to be amusing to pull a heap policeman's hat down over his eyes, and, or had been adjudged to be shouting obscenities in too loud a voice, and he dished out punishments to them. But there was nothing that warranted court of inquiry or court martial or anything like that. But the thing that struck me was that, in fact, how good humoured it was. I mean, Andy didn't hand out more than David Douglas any punishment for his little grin on his face. He gave people a hell of a bollocking. They both did at different levels. But it was taken by the victims or the accused in good part, the fact that they'd been nailed and sent up on a fizzer, as it was called, on a charge, and the fact that they'd been punished. And of course, punishment went down to somebody's record sheet if they were beyond a trifle. So it did count for promotion and so on. But all taken in good part, yes, you know, I got so and so from the Andy, and he gave me my goodness, he really tore my balls off. Then I sort of shake of the head and, I deserved that. No hard feelings. And I can't remember ever again seeing this in action with the second battalion, because we were never in a position to have the equivalent of certainly, and of course, when you are fighting it in action, nothing incurring punishments ever comes up.
Now, you missed Hogmanay.
Oh, yes. Well, we had been told about this. We're going down to the Sudan. That means a trip in a boat. It also meant catching a train from Amaria all the way down to Suez, I think, rather than Port Said. So New Year's Eve, we spent sitting on the sand by a railway line all through the night, waiting, I think, something like 7 or 8 hours for a train to arrive, which was, as I say, hours and hours late. We hadn't a dram between us. It was the most melancholy Hogmanay I think anybody had ever spent. And then we got down the train to the boat, very comfortable boat, which had been on the Spanish run before the war. It was only a few days going down the Red Sea to Port Sudan. Beginning of January by definition, the Red Sea wasn't a burning furnace. It was pleasantly warm. So, I mean, we did PT by companies, but then we danced a lot of reels. Great thing about reels is you don't need women to dance them. Women add much to the pleasure of a reel. But you can set a whole company of men dancing reels. And it's very good exercise as well as good fun. And we had the pipers, of course, and our adjutant, Tony Noble. He was magic on the squeeze box, the big concertina. And the same thing, I mean, he used to play this for sing-songs. When we got to Port Sudan, I was nominated the baggage officer. I'd been baggage officer for loading up the ship.
Now, what did that entail as baggage?
Well, you had to, in agreement with the transport officer, who was the army chap on the ship, and he in turn was the actual number one in charge of stowing stuff in the holds. You had to get the kit loaded in sequence for unloading. And the main thing is you had to try and keep an eye on the kit not being pinched. And both in Egypt and in the Sudan, anything and everything that wasn't nailed down or had somebody standing guard over it was whipped at once. There was a thriving black market in anything. And I lost, some things got lost, but nothing too much. But it was an abominable job, baggage officer. And I vowed to myself I'd do anything possible to avoid ever being baggage officer again. And I must say, to the end of the war, I was able to keep that promise to myself. I never was a baggage officer again.
Now, Port Sudan, where is that exactly?
Well, it's not much of a port, it's so-called. There is a small town, and there's a sort of a harbour.
Is it in Sudan?
In Sudan itself. At one point, the Sudan does run along the coast of the Red Sea. And it's there that the people who know the area say that's where the Fuzzy Wuzzies used to come from. The people who proved such a headache to Kitchener and Co. in the war after the after Gordon of Khartoum, like that. Now they're still there, wonderful fuzzy headdresses and huge spears. But we were only there. Well, we landed there and were taken by train inland. To again another temporary camp, but this time near a railway junction which had a huge water tank up on legs, so no shortage of water. And there we did group marching. Again, we thought that we hadn't been using our legs enough for a bit, so we marched and marched every day. Little bit of drill, since we hadn't done any drill at all at the Bagouche box.
And this would be at Haya, H-A-I-Y-A, railway
junction. Which was nothing except this railway junction. I know that I can recollect no buildings. And then we were told that what we were going to do was from the Sudan, we were going to invade Eritrea. The object being to neutralize what put the Italians out of the war in that part of the world, B, get the Emperor of Ethiopia back on the throne, and C, which is probably, if you like, the most important, was to neutralize the port of Massawa on the Red Sea as a submarine base, because so much stuff was still coming around the Cape, going up the Red Sea, that submarines there were one or two Italian submarines, and it would be easy enough for eventually German submarines or more Italian submarines to make the long trip around and reinforce them. And of course we had wholly the wrong idea. We thought, goodness, the ITIs were cakewalk in the desert. We had no bother with them, apart from a few unfortunate casualties. But we soon learned how wrong we were, because I was later told by an Italian officer, was that in the desert, at that time, the Italian divisions were just black shirt livies, really peasants from the south of Italy shoved into uniform, given a rifle until they were now in the army. Whereas down in Eritrea, which had been an Italian colony since the 1880s, I think, there was the regiments of the regular Italian army, who were good, very good. There were also most efficient local Eritrean soldiers officered by Italians, and they were good. A lot of them, of course, were diverted because Abyssinia had been conquered by the Italians in theory, but really all they held was a series of strong points, garrisons in towns, and certain fortifications, natural fortifications, mountains and things, which they had gone on to fortify a bit. And they did control some of the main roads that they had built between places. But in no way could one have said that Abyssinia was an Italian colony by this time. And so they had to keep more troops than they would have wished, I think, in Abyssinia, sort of holding it down. In Eritrea, there were any number of Italian settlers who'd been there two or three generations. As I say, there were some very good Eritrean soldiers in Italian uniform. And that was much more like a highly organized, efficiently run overseas colony.
Now, what was the plan? You were to head for Casale, weren't you?
Well, yes. Casale, actually, the Italians, rather as in Libya, they made a half-hearted move forward. And from Libya, captured Sidibarani and a bit of the countryside round about it. The Italians had total success, attacked and overrun British Somalia, which is on the Indian Ocean coast, south of the Horn of Africa, south of Abyssinia. There was one British battalion there, so there isn't much trouble conquering that. And then they apparently, I told later, a school of thought that the Italians should have invaded the Sudan properly and captured Khartoum, and this would have compelled the British to send a lot of troops down there, which would in turn have made it possible for Graziani to move across the North African coast and get the Suez Canal. And the other lot the commandant, the Duke of Aosta, was commanding the Italian forces. The other lot of his advisors said that because the Suez Canal was shut, they were going to get no more reinforcements, no more supplies, plenty of food they had, no more ammunition was going to reach them, and they'd do far better to sit tight. And what they actually did was a sort of half-hearted thing, as from Libya. They invaded the Sudan, which, you know, a great deal of hoo-ha in the papers about it, capturing a town on the border called Casale. And then they stopped. So we were going to go to Casale, recapture Casale, and then move into Eritrea, which is a long, narrow country, very mountainous, running between the Sudan border, running along the edge of the Abyssinian border until this long narrow country hits the Red Sea with its port at Massawa. And halfway between one end and the other, up in a high plateau, was a town called Asmara, which is the capital. And there are two roads, both running along the length of the country, a southerly one and a northerly one. The plan was for the 4th Indian Division, our division, to move along the northward road, and when the road branched off to the south, the 5th Indian Division, which had now arrived from India, I think, or two brigades had arrived, they would go around by the southerly route. Off we went. It was rather good. The Sudan, where we had been, was terribly like the desert. A lot of rocky outcrops, but it was arid and the scrub bushes would get down to the edge of Eritrea, and there was some forested ground. Beautiful birds flitting to and fro. And I thought we must have been camping there in a riverbed, which probably ran as a river in the winter rains and dried up in the summer. But now we went off to Cameron's leading along the road towards Asmara.
Now you were attacked by bombers, I think.
We were attacked by bombers. And also, at the first place, we had a hold up. The Italians held successive positions to delay the advance, I think, while the proper defences were being got ready further back. And first of these places was called Keru, K-E-R-U, where there was a steep ridge of hills which the Italians were holding, and a very narrow pass through which the road went. And one had to clear the hills first. But eventually, really after a bit of shooting, not many casualties, we got through. Not before, though. Well, there was bombing. And A Company lost a few casualties from the bombing. But the drama, which I never saw, unfortunately, was the gunner regiment was attacked in a cavalry charge, which I think must have been about the last cavalry charge in history, led by an officer. He always called in the division. You remember that chap on the white horse? He commanded the thing at the head of his galloping troops, waving a sword, on a white horse. And the gunners finally beat them off by, in fact, you know, swinging the guns round and firing point blank. They, well, fruitless, but it was a gallant effort. I met him after the war, the man on the white horse. We had to push on and push on as fast as we could. That meant sometimes getting a lift on lorries. Very often it meant marching. And compared to the desert, the heat was, even though it was still January, was intense.
What effects did it have on you and the men?
Well, if you were marching, you were marching not cross country. You were marching along a sort of tarmac road. If possible, if you could stand the dust that was kicked up at the edges of the road, were smoothish, sandy surface. And in some ways it was easier on the feet marching there than on the actual tarmac. The real problem was, as so often, water. And this is where old training in water discipline was really important, because we knew that unless something disastrous happened, that about 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, we'd reach our ration lorries, which pushed on ahead, and we would get more water, we'd get something to eat, and above all, whatever we were dying to get, of course, was get about half a gallon of char inside them. But while you were trudging along between, say, 11 and 4, with the usual army system of you march for 50 minutes and then you had a 10-minute ride, the unwise people took their boots off and then had great difficulty getting them on again. And then up and off you went again. It was too hot, too dusty, we were all too thirsty, certainly for any false gaiety like singing or anything like this. You couldn't even dare ask the company piper to play because he was as parched as the rest of them. There was never a question of saying at a halt, right, you may all have now one mouthful from your water bottle. But it certainly was the case at the halt to say to the platoon, right, here we are. Don't forget your water bottles, and now I've still got X hours to last you, and the heat's going to get worse, not less. And I tried the old thing about sucking a pebble. I don't think it made any difference whatsoever. but it was at least something to do. And then, of course, there was actually this was a bit of an acid test for the what we still thought of as the Free British, because they had not long before they'd been sent to us come off a troop ship, and they were not accustomed. I mean, they hadn't had route marching. And this was a real strain for them to, and they stuck to it pretty well. We did have one or two fall out with heat exhaustion, and there was some system, and I've quite forgotten what it was now. We did have a lorry at the back of the whole column that could pick up people who had collapsed with heat stroke almost, I suppose. But it was a great relief to see the water wagon and the cooks when we finally got up with them. This where we started seeing odd signs of battle action, because we were preceded by what was called the Sudan Defense Force. And this was like a sort of almost old-fashioned cavalry regiment in advance. This was the Sudan did have a defense force, a sort of militia, if you like. They were, I must say, super people, very highly trained. They were equipped with sort of pickup trucks with a Bren gun mounted on them. So it was a kind of armored car. And they whizzed along. Each carrier. So the Sudanese nipped out with their rifles and did a quick flanking movement, and if there was a party holding up the road, got rid of them. And one came across odd corpses that had been the result of these encounters. So we knew things were warming up until we got to, there was quite a big town, and this is where the two roads forked, the North Road and the South Road, if I'm right. A place called Agadat, which had been, I think, a provincial capital. It was quite a big market town. We never were in the town proper, but it appeared from a distance to have municipal buildings and villas and barracks and shopping, apart from native markets and shopping centres. Quite a biggish place, and the Italians had put up a good defence here, a very strong position, because it was the mountains were ideal for defence, devilish steep, and to any soldiers to climb up them carrying a rifle and a bandolier of ammunition and his water bottle. Was a tremendous effort, and the difficulty was that this went on for the following 2 months in all our mountain warfare, you did have suffer casualties in the climb up. When you got to the top, you A, had too few men, really, to stand up against a counterattack. B, you desperately needed more ammunition, and if you were leading soldiers up in the attack, you couldn't have the same soldiers humping up more ammunition, water, tins of bully beef. Great problem in mountain warfare, and this was our first experience of it.